From WNYC in New York, this is NPR's On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield.
And I'm Brooke Gladstone.
Some of people's concerns have grown out of bogus claims spread by those whose only agenda is to kill reform at any cost.
This week's joint session of Congress was notable for the presence of emotion at the podium.
That we plan to set up panels of bureaucrats with the power to kill off senior citizens. Now, such a charge would be laughable if it weren't so cynical and irresponsible. It is a lie, plain and simple.
It was also notable for the absence of civility from the floor.
There are also those who claim that our reform efforts would ensure illegal immigrants. This, too, is false. The reforms I'm proposing would not apply to those who are here illegally.
Now, there are other democracies where leader heckling is almost de rigueur. The British parliamentary system seems to lend itself to a certain churlishness.
Education over 10 years, it couldn't have happened under a Liberal or Conservative government.
Yeah. Speaker, there comes a point when stubbornness isn't leadership, it's stupidity. Well, at least I say it to his face.
Question time, when members of parliament have at their prime minister, is a hallowed tradition. America has its traditions too. Fred Beitler, deputy historian for the United States House of Representatives, says having the president address a joint session of Congress was actually made an American institution by a 20th century president.
Woodrow Wilson, he was a student of Congress, and what he wanted to do by addressing Congress is to lay out his legislative program and really take the agenda away from the legislative branch. He actually speaks 9 times within 2 years.
You know, before you came on, we played a little clip from British Prime Minister Gordon Brown getting rudely insulted during the Parliament's traditional question time. Now, Americans generally don't savage their chiefs of state in the halls of Congress.
There is some sort of murmuring during the Reagan administration. I don't believe there is during Bush Sr. There starts, though, with Bill Clinton's health care issue. There was some snickering and some murmurs of dissent, so that was much more vocal back in 1993. But it's usually 20 to 30 members kind of expressing that murmur rather than any single individual.
So you've heard rumbles all along, but this outburst by Congressman Wilson seems to be unprecedented?
By a single individual identifiable member.
So what do you make of this "you lie" from the floor? Is it a blip? Is it a sign of the apocalypse? You said that registering disapproval during these addresses has grown since Bill Clinton. From a historical perspective, what do you make of this?
Well, possibly a good analogy would be to what happens when there's a similar kind of outburst on the House floor when we're in regular session. The individual's words will be what's called taken down, basically stricken from the record. And usually what happens after that is most of the members realize that a line had been crossed, and there gets to be afterwards quite a while of a much more civil and much more careful environment, at least that I noticed in the immediate aftermath. Looking in the future, I would imagine that next time Mr. Obama speaks, I'm sure it would be quite civil and everybody will be on his best behavior.
Fred, thank you very much.
Okay.
Fred Beitler is the deputy historian for the U.S. House of Representatives. Dana Milbank is a columnist for The Washington Post. He says that despite what most of us saw on TV during the joint session of Congress, really, you had to be there.
I go out and cover the scene every day here in Washington, and often it's a pretty dreary or dull scene, but every now and then something just explodes in front of you, and it's almost like an out-of-body experience, and you say, did that man who I'm looking down on, you know, 15 feet away from me, did he actually just shout, "You lie," at the President of the United States who's standing over there? You got to see the Republicans were waving copies of their alternative proposal at Obama. Some Democrats cheering for Obama, you know, putting the V for victory sign, one fellow pumping his fist in the air, and then at one point opening his fist, which unfortunately seemed to resemble a fascist salute, which I doubt Thanks. That he intended. You hear mutterings and cries of shame or booing or hissing that you probably don't pick up on television because the microphones are not with each individual member, and that's probably a good thing. It would be pretty noisy. As it happened, I was on that side where Mr. Wilson had his outburst, so I could watch him playing with his BlackBerry and puffing out his cheeks. He knew he'd stepped in it right away, so he spent the next half an hour in some agony.
If you could, what did you see and hear that was so different from other sessions of this kind?
I think what was occurring here was sort of the culmination of what we'd seen over the summer, and basically the spilling out of raw anger into the public arena now had come finally to the sacred ritual of American democracy, the speech to the joint session of Congress. It was almost like a primal scream. I think more and more it is all about the theatrics, and what you saw last night, even though it appeared that there was rapt silence in the chamber, is all kinds of people thumbing their BlackBerries while the tribute was being made to Ted Kennedy, fidgeting, getting up and leaving early. Charitably, you'd call it an informality, but I think more likely there has been a gradual erosion in respect paid not to the president, but to the office of the presidency. And I think, you know, over the 15 years I've been covering politics in this town, that was certainly the lowest I'd seen.
You referred in your column to the dignified nature of presidential addresses to joint congressional sessions. Traditionally, you know, there was some hand-wringing a few years back that Fox News, which has a conscious talk radio sensibility, was setting the tone for political discourse in the media post 9/11. But it also seems like over time, that tone has saturated Washington.
I think it has. I don't know if it's necessarily Fox News or just the changing media culture. There's really no limit on what you can say, and that does seem to have bled over into our national politics. But that doesn't mean it's caused by the media culture.
But something seems to be defining civility down.
It seems like each time we reach a new low, something else has to replace it that's even more shocking. So I suspect this is not the last time somebody heckles the president during a speech to a joint session.
Dana, thank you very much.
My pleasure, Brooke.
Dana Milbank is a columnist for The Washington Post. Here's a common refrain you may have heard resounding in town halls from the critics of the president's proposed health care changes. Rep. John Conyers said he really didn't see the point.
I love these members that get up and say, read the bill. What good is reading the bill if it's 1,000 pages and you don't have 2 days and two lawyers to find out what it means after you read the bill?
But even if he had decided to read the bill he's supposed to vote on, he'd still have to pick which version to read. Democrats in the House and Senate have different proposals. A bipartisan group of senators is discussing a compromise plan, and both the Republicans and the president have outlines of their own. One incentive for Conyers to pick the House Democrats' version of the bill: he could listen to it on his iPod. A group of voice actors have formed a website called hearthebill.com, where they're posting an audio version.
H.R. 3200, to provide affordable, quality health care for all Americans and reduce the growth.
So why does this bill rate its own MP3? And why, after passing the largely unread Patriot Act and the stimulus bill, both of which cut to the heart of American values and fears every bit as much as the health care bill, is suddenly everyone so big on reading? We called Ken Silverstein, who covers Washington for Harper's Magazine. Hello, Ken.
Hi.
So it seems to me that this bill is being read or misread a lot more noisily than many others. But listen to these guys.
Read the bill! Read the bill!
You get the sense that suddenly reading is, you know, really fundamental. What gives?
Well, bills are passed constantly that no one has read. If you were to go to some of these members who are most vocally complaining about this, look at their committee assignments, and then look at the bills that that committee approved and then were voted on by the full Congress, and ask them, oh, tell me about that bill. You know, tell me about page 63 and this important provision. They won't have the foggiest idea of what you're talking
about.
Sounds
like a trick question to me.
It is sort of a trick question, but even if you were to be maybe a little bit fairer and just ask them to tell you about some of the very important provisions in some of the bills that they voted on in recent years, huge, huge bills, they will not be able to discuss those bills in anything other than generalities. Now, partly that's because the only people who read bills, if they're read at all, are staffers. Members of Congress never read these bills. They don't have time. A few years ago, I wrote about an appropriations bill, the massive bills that fund the departments of the federal government. They're among the most important bills that Congress deals with. These things are routinely voted on, and no one has read them. I mean, I wrote about one bill in particular. It was $16 billion in money, and it was actually finished at 12:15 a.m., and it was voted on 16 hours later.
In your piece, you said that if they'd wanted to read the bill, they would have had to have read 208 pages an hour, every hour, for 16 hours.
Exactly. And, you know, that was if they happened to be cruising the House website where it was posted at 12:15 a.m. and they'd stayed up all night because of this page turner that they just couldn't put down. I mean, this happens all the time.
As a citizen, one would think that what we could do to help is to read the bill, or a bill if we could get a hold of one, but they're largely unreadable.
In subparagraph A, by striking subparagraph B and inserting subparagraphs B and D, and subparagraph B by adding at the end the following.
Ooh, wait a second, I love this part.
Quote, subparagraph D.
So what's a news consumer to do?
Go to organizations that are monitoring and tracking and analyzing the bill, and they will have the highlights, the really exciting parts, on their websites, and they will have analyzed the exciting parts, and it'll spare you, as the public citizen and consumer, having to read the whole thing yourself.
So name a couple of those.
You probably want to check out websites on both sides of the debate. I know, for example, Public Citizen, which would be on the left side, has information about healthcare reform. To see what members of Congress are being funded by what interest groups, go to opensecrets.org, which is a very good website that tracks campaign finance and also usually will analyze issues as well. There's factcheck.org and politifact.com that will check the assertions that are made and let you know who's lying and who's telling you the truth or somewhere in between. VoteSmart.org will take you to a list of organizations that are advocating for healthcare reform, whether pro or con. This is everybody from the AARP to the Children's Health Fund to the Global AIDS Alliance. There's a list of probably about 30 or 40 groups. So there are ways to cut through the fog without subjecting yourself to reading the entire bill, which won't make you any smarter anyway, because you'll have fallen asleep after about page 6.
Ken, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Ken Silverstein covers Washington for Harper's Magazine.
Coming up, an AP photograph showing the sacrifice of war worsens one family's pain, and a real-life Where's Waldo is finally found.
This is On the Media from NPR.
Hey, pod people. This is Katya, senior producer of OTM. Finally, for the first time ever, you can get an On the Media t-shirt, a notebook, a refrigerator magnet, a mouse pad, whatever. We got it. If you want it, you can find it by clicking the link on our website, onthemedia.org.
This is On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield.
And I'm Brooke Gladstone. It's an argument as old as photography itself. Governments don't like ugly battlefield pictures of the wars they're waging. Should First Amendment wonks always stand up for the right to print? Nightmarish photos of trench warfare were suppressed during World War I. When they were finally released, the depth of the government's deception gave rise, critics say, to the cynical lost generation of the 20s. Some in the military still believe that the grisly TV footage from Vietnam, our first living room war, sapped the nation's will to win. Those critics claim that the decision to publish is often more about politics than journalism. Now, the latest example. Marine Lance Corporal Joshua Bernard of New Portland, Maine, in Afghanistan, captured by an Associated Press photographer in the act of dying, one leg apparently blown away. AP called the soldier's family. The family asked the news outlet not to release it. Defense Secretary Robert Gates called to add his support to the family's request. AP released it anyway. Jeff Morrell is Deputy Assistant Secretary of Defense for Public Affairs and the Pentagon Press Secretary. Welcome to the show.
My pleasure, Brooke.
So, Secretary of Defense Robert Gates said that printing the photo over the objections of the family was unconscionable and appalling. Can you sum up his argument for why it shouldn't have been published?
It is a very graphic and gruesome photograph, but we are not objecting to the graphic or gruesome nature of it, as appalling as the secretary and many of us found it to be. What we are objecting to is the fact that the family clearly asked the AP not to run the photograph because it would add to their pain, and yet they proceeded with publication. He thought their behavior, their decision-making, was wrong. and that they should, as he tries to, when in doubt, always defer to the wishes of the family. It's the least we can do for these families who have given up one of their own.
They are so vulnerable and they've sacrificed so much. And yet, do you think, does the secretary think that they should have final say over what a news outlet decides is news that's fit to print?
I don't think the secretary believes that. I don't believe that. I don't think we're making a great pronouncement about the future of photography on the battlefield. We're talking about one particular family dealing with one particularly tragic loss of life. And in this case, they asked for AP not to publish, and the AP proceeded to anyway, and the secretary thought that was appalling.
Now, the AP didn't do this cavalierly. It was part of a huge piece called Death of a Marine, and it came with a 1,700-word piece on the battle, a series of photos, the photographer's journal, interviews with Bernard's family. It wasn't just thrown onto the wire for titillation.
Yes, they clearly had thought long and hard about it. They just arrived ultimately at the wrong decision as far as the family and we are concerned. There are other photographs, as you mentioned, that accompanied this story, which adequately represented the horrors of that particular battle. And in fact, the vast majority of news outlets chose not to run this particular graphic photograph. And if they did indeed run this story, they ran other photographs to accompany it. I think only a handful of newspapers had actually run this. And the secretary was very appreciative of the fact that the vast majority of news outlets had shown good judgment and not run this photograph.
Well, then I guess you would say that the system worked. AP is a wire service. It offers this stuff. The main paper where Lance Corporal Bernard grew up didn't run it, but it was run in other locations.
The fact is, Brooke, the family wished for no one to publish this photograph. So whether it's 1, 3, 5, 15, or 50, the damage has been done, according to this family. The problem with what AP ultimately did was, by pushing this photograph out, they have given their blessing to this photograph. And many of these newspapers don't, frankly, go through the editorial tug of war that AP clearly did leading up to this. It's up to them, frankly, to be the gatekeeper for their clients on what is ethically appropriate to publish.
The AP photographer Julie Jacobson published a journal that she kept. And at one point she asks, and I'm going to quote her, "With great respect and understanding to all the opposing arguments in publication, I feel that as journalists, it is our social responsibility to record and publish such images. We have no restrictions to shoot or publish casualties from opposition forces or even civilian casualties. Are those people less human than American or other NATO soldiers?"
These aren't restrictions. We're not looking to change any rules. We're not looking to make it more restrictive or more onerous for reporters to do their work. We are the biggest champions of reporters in the battlefield. This is a secretary who only months after coming into office went to the United States Naval Academy, the United States Air Force Academy, and at their commencements told them flat out, the press is not the enemy, and to treat it as such is self-defeating. This is the guy who opened up Dover Air Force Base for the first time for photographers so they could see returning war dead. This is the person who credits the press for uncovering the ills that, in terms of outpatient care at Walter Reed Army Medical Center. He is a champion of the press. He is a proponent of the press. But he also believes it is incumbent upon the press to exercise good judgment and not be detached from the horrors of this war and the pain and suffering that families go through as a result of it.
Let me ask you about the AP's fundamental point, that a photo like this, by its very graphic nature, cuts through the abstractions of death tolls and numbers and even names.
Well, that is precisely, Brooke, why we have been such a champion over the last 8 years of trying to get the media as close as we possibly can to this experience. And that's why you've got reporters all over the battlefield. And so I don't think it's lost on the American people 8 years after these conflicts began what the consequences of war are.
There has been, though, over the course of all of these years, a great reluctance to show photographs of dead or mortally wounded soldiers, American soldiers. We've seen quite a bit of gore, but not so much inflicted on our own troops.
Well, that's ultimately the judgment of each news organization, and it's one, frankly, that we've applauded because we don't think that it takes a particularly gruesome photograph of a recognizable soldier or Marine, airman, or sailor to convey the cost of war. Overall, the news judgment that's been exercised over the past 8 years has been exemplary. This situation is the exception and not the rule, thankfully.
Jeff, thank you very much.
My pleasure, Brooke. Thanks for having me.
Jeff Morrell is Deputy Assistant Secretary of Defense for Public Affairs and Pentagon Press Secretary. Santiago Lyon is the Director of Photography for the AP. He told us that the controversial photo was just too important not to run.
I think this photo was key to understanding what happened that day in Afghanistan because it shows the very real and terrible and awful effects of warfare. There are many thousands of soldiers and military personnel serving over there, and comparatively few journalists embedded with them. And because there are a set of very detailed rules regarding the embedding of journalists with the military that require that the family members be notified before any of this imagery can be released. And in some cases, that kills the immediacy of the information, and sometimes the information doesn't come out.
This may seem to be a strange question coming from a reporter, but is immediacy really that essential in a story like this? An anecdote that's meant to stand in for a great deal more about the sacrifice of war?
Well, indeed, and that's why in this particular case, almost 3 weeks passed between when the incident happened and when we released the information, the story, the photograph. That is indicative of the care and the seriousness that we took in reporting this particular story.
Are you saying that the circumstances of getting this story and this photograph are so unusual that AP could not have, say, held out for a case where the family actually okayed the release of the photograph? Because obviously and unfortunately, he's not going to be the last casualty.
Well, it is unusual for the reasons I described. We don't see these photographs very often. When we went to see the family, we didn't go to request their permission. When we contacted the military, we didn't contact them to request their permission. What we were doing was, in both cases, alerting them to the fact that we had this material, gathering information from them as it was relevant to the story, and then ultimately proceeding with the distribution of the images.
Secretary Gates has stated publicly that the media should not be treated as the enemy by the military. He's praised the press for uncovering everything from inadequate armor to the horrible conditions at Walter Reed. But when you ignore his request to respect the wishes of a grieving family, don't you risk undermining the improved relationship between the media and the military? Is it worth the price for this one photo?
Well, I think it is in the sense that it's our duty to inform the public. If we pause and backpedal because the Secretary of Defense objects to the image in support of the family, we're doing ourselves and the general public a disservice.
I don't know if you saw this, Tom Ricks. For 8 years, he was the Washington Post defense reporter, wrote last Saturday on the foreign policy blog, quote, "Today I am embarrassed for American journalism. As a former military reporter, I'm also angry with the AP. They've committed the sin, but all of us in the media will pay for it. This one will haunt us for years. The Marines especially don't forget."
Well, for me, it's interesting that the Marines on the ground in Afghanistan, from the commanding general of that particular battalion down to the company commander, have told us that they really don't have a problem with what we did, that they understand that it's our job to photograph and capture reality, and that we did our job. They really don't seem that concerned about it, and this is coming from the men on the ground actually fighting the war.
Santiago, thank you very much.
Thank you. My pleasure.
Santiago Lyon is the Director of Photography for the Associated Press.
The hunt for Evan Ratliff lasted 24 days. Ratliff, you may remember from a few weeks back, is the Wired magazine writer who wrote about how countless people try to disappear and reemerge with new identities. Ratliff decided to try it himself to see if he could shed his identity despite all of the digital footprints he and the rest of us leave everywhere we go, from Facebook and Flickr to frequent flyer miles and credit cards. So Ratliff disappeared. His editor, Nick Thompson, acted as a private investigator, feeding clues via a blog to anyone who wanted to join the chase. The reward for finding Evan within 30 days, $5,000, $3,000 of which come out of Evan's own pocket. The rule, Evan would act like someone who really wanted to start over. He couldn't just camp out in Yellowstone for a month. He had to live in cities, spend money, try to get a job, basically to start a new life. Had he evaded capture for just a few more days, he'd be $3,000 richer now. But alas, Evan Ratliff, welcome back to On the Media.
Thank you.
Okay, so first of all, Jason Bourne, you're not.
Apparently not.
Give me an idea of what you did to hide your tracks.
In terms of digitally hiding my tracks, I used a piece of software called Tor, which is used often by dissidents and people trying to keep their internet surfing private. And I used that software to hide a lot of my connections when I was logging on to follow people who were searching for me. On top of that, I had fake email accounts, fake Twitter account, I had fake Facebook account, and I was using those to kind of set up my new identity while leaving behind most of my old one.
Now, this turned out to be one of your mistakes. What were the names on these various accounts that you set up?
The new name that I was operating under was James Donald Gatz. James Gatz being Jay Gatsby's original name in The Great Gatsby, and Donald being my middle name, partly because it's really hard to operate under a fake name. Using my middle name was easier to respond to it. It also allowed me to then shift, and I started using James or JD once I got further along.
Was there anywhere, for example, on your Facebook page that you had made public the fact that you're a fan of F. Scott Fitzgerald and The Great Gatsby?
I had. So once people came across that name, it wasn't that difficult for them to sort of connect it with my own profile that they'd already developed using everything that I'd left online.
When we spoke to Nick Thompson a couple of weeks ago, he suggested that one way you may get caught is by trying to track your trackers, and that you would be somehow baited into an e-trap.
That was absolutely the case. In fact, I listened to that interview with Nick, and I knew that's how they were trying to catch me, but the problem was that when you're on the run and you don't have any idea how close people are, the level of paranoia just goes off the charts. Everyone that I encountered that even looked my way, I thought, oh, well, this is the guy, this is the woman who's looking for me. So obsessively monitoring my pursuers was the only way for me to keep myself remotely grounded in thinking, well, okay, they're not that close, or I know they're looking here, so I'll try to direct them there.
Now, I must tell you that I have read two accounts of the means by which you were finally ID'd and nabbed, but understood almost not a word of it. I would like you to heroically attempt to explain to me how they did eventually track you down.
The basics of it are that I appeared in a video. In that video, I had a certain look that I was using at the beginning, goatee and kind of long hair and these Harry Potter round glasses. I later leaked that video because I wanted people to think that I still looked like that, and I had changed my look. I had shaved my head. One of the trackers who was following me, whose name is Jeff and he lives in Seattle, when he saw that video, he noticed a similarity between that and a picture of someone who was following the pursuit on Facebook, which was me in my fake account. Once he noticed that, he started unraveling my fake accounts, and he had fake Twitter accounts that he used to try to follow my Twitter. He contacted people who were following my Twitter because it was closed to the public. Then he used that information to figure out that I was logging on to his website without protecting my internet address because I didn't actually believe that he could log my location that easily. And I also thought it would kind of get lost in the noise. Once he had my internet address, he could narrow that down to where I was staying, which was New Orleans. Then he got in touch with a pizza place here that makes gluten-free pizza. I have celiac disease, so I have to eat a gluten-free diet. And so he knew I was interested in that pizza place, and then he enlisted them to basically find me, and they tracked me down at a book reading.
Any thoughts as to what would make Jeff or anybody devote the amount of time to tracking down a total stranger?
I can, and I don't think it was about the money. In the same way that I was kind of living out a fantasy about vanishing from their life, and I got emails from people along the way who were saying, I've always wanted to do this, and I've thought about it, and how hard is it really, and that kind of thing. I feel like people on the other side who were chasing me were getting to live out a fantasy of being the PI and getting to best me. I was trying to hide, they were trying to catch me, and we were both completely wrapped up in it.
Does the fact that you got caught in less than the 30 days allotted to this chase tell you anything about, in the real world, whether it is possible nowadays to really vanish from the face of the earth?
Of course, a person who's going to normally vanish would probably not do a lot of things that I did. I mean, the best thing to do is to not go online. You really have to drop everything. I mean, it's not just the overlap with your old life. It's really using any of your new life technologies to follow the pursuit or return to your background in any way. It's really, really difficult not to do, but it's the only way for someone to actually get away if they want to do it over a long period of time.
All right, Evan, welcome back to your old life, and thank you.
Thank you.
Evan Ratliff is a contributor for Wired magazine. He'll write about his account of this whole ordeal in the December issue of Wired.
This is On the Media from NPR.
Support for On the Media comes from the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, helping NPR advance journalistic excellence in the digital age. The John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, committed to building a more just, verdant and peaceful world. More information at macfound.org. And the Wallace Foundation, a source of ideas for expanding learning opportunities beyond the school day, at wallacefoundation.org. This is NPR.
This is On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield. Friday marked the 8th anniversary of the attacks of September 11th, offering the so-called 9/11 truthers yet another opportunity to advance their case that the U.S. government was behind the destruction of the World Trade Center. Some even believe bombs were planted inside the towers. Actor and truther Charlie Sheen requested an interview with President Obama. Then he wrote a 20-minute transcript of how he imagined that interview might go. Sheen explained to fellow truther Alex Jones that he wanted to put his case on the record, even if he had to invent Obama's answers.
I wanted to create a public document specifically rooted in fact. If anybody dares question that, I would encourage those people to scrutinize it, to research it. The truth is unchanging, Alex, as we both know.
The truthers claim they glean their facts largely from the mainstream media. But as often happens with evidence gathered in support of a strongly held conviction, many of those news reports are taken out of context. WNYC reporter Beth Fertig got a taste of that when her eyewitness account of the World Trade Center attacks was adopted and adapted by the truthers. Here's a recording of her at the scene of the attacks, trying to describe to a WNYC host what she had just witnessed.
Did it indeed sound like an explosion or perhaps the sound of collapsing building material? Can you differentiate?
It did. You know, in those scenes when they tear down a building and, you know, a building that's been planned to come down and you hear that planned explosion sound, it almost sounded like that.
It was my description of watching the first tower go down.
WNYC's Beth Fertig.
In my mind, it resembled a controlled demolition and that it went down so perfectly that part of my brain was wondering if it actually was a controlled demolition because I thought, you know, in this weird little fantasy of mine, oh my God, maybe they got everyone out and now they're bringing the building down in a safe way. You know, it was nuts of me to even think that. But at that moment, you don't know what's happening. You know, I just saw the building go down and was wondering how could that happen.
But others seized upon that observation. Have they exploited your analogy?
It was really strange to find this out because I didn't know about it until fairly recently. I wrote a book about the public schools, which is what I normally write about, the New York City public schools. And I was searching on the Amazon.com website to see if the book had been listed yet. And I saw my name listed in a whole bunch of other books. Some of them were these journalism books that I'd written essays for about 9/11, what it was like covering the event. But then I saw these two others that I'd never heard about. One was called Abuse Your Illusions, The Disinformation Guide to Media Mirages and Establishment Lies. And the other is called Christian Faith and the Truth Behind 9/11, A Call to Reflection and Action. And they were using that description that I gave as looking like a controlled demolition to say, aha, it really was a controlled demolition.
Yeah, I once sat in my old Volkswagen and sat on a yellow jacket and got stung and imagined for an instant that somehow someone had put a snake in my car. It was a combination of pain and paranoia. And in any event, I did find the dead bee, and that quickly put snake thoughts out of my mind forever. But it's as though years later, someone would print a book saying, yes, people are putting snakes on your car. Here's Bob Garfield's experience to prove it.
Yeah. Later this year, after I discovered this just by coincidence, somebody wrote to me from, I think he was in Australia, and he was looking into these conspiracy theories, and he said, I want to ask you about that description that you gave. And I said, look, you know, don't use this for attribution or anything, but I'm just going to tell you, it was just a metaphor. I was saying, this is what it looked like. And he kept writing to me and writing to me, and I said, look, just enough already.
As you report now, do you think about how the words in your scripts could be edited and spliced so as to support some viewpoint that you want no association with whatsoever?
I couldn't think that way. If I thought that way, I wouldn't be able to do my job. You know, I'd always be like, what if-ing? You know, if somebody wants to seize on a quote that I've used, you know, go ahead. It's out there. And these conspiracy theorists, they can do whatever they want. My work is public work. I just feel badly that it's been twisted to further their agenda, an agenda that I wouldn't want to be associated with, because my job is to look into things and report them fairly.
So it seems to me that we have discovered the difference between conspiracy theorists and reporters. Both methodically assemble facts, and both may actually enter a story with a notion or a premise. The reporter will assemble all the facts and use that to try to flesh out the truth. A conspiracy theorist only keeps the facts that support his or her theory. Is that what it comes down to?
I don't know. I would like to think that I and my colleagues in the mainstream media, or whatever you want to call us, look into the facts and we report them accurately. But then we're sometimes accused of having an agenda. People will say, oh, you only use this quote, you took it out of context. So maybe the lines aren't so neat as you describe them, Bob, but I do think that there is a difference in terms of the conspiracy theorists having an agenda and then finding quotes that are going to back up their arguments, which is what they did with my words.
Beth Fertig is a reporter for WNYC and a contributor to NPR. Beth, thank you.
Thanks.
That book that she wrote is titled Why Can't You Teach Me to Read? Three Students and a Mayor Put Our Schools to the Test.
We don't usually take notice of September 11th anniversaries, not having much to add. But a new book just came in that explores how Hollywood has processed that terrible day in the 8 years since, so we thought we'd take a minute to remember. On that day, people running from the wreckage or watching on TV all used a common vocabulary to describe what they'd seen.
Talk to me about what it was like. Were you able to get out?
It was like a World War II war movie. I mean, there was just debris everywhere.
Whether science fiction or horror, whatever the genre, it was like a movie. We've enjoyed so many disasters from the darkness of a theater, we never imagined one could ever burst forth into the light of a late summer morning. Did the reality change our view of cinematic explosions? For perspective, in September of 2001, I asked Variety columnist Tim Gray about the audience response to an explosive hit back in 1996. When you saw Independence Day,
right,
when the White House blew up,
right,
did your audience cheer?
Yeah, it was like, whoa! I mean, up until a week ago, you would see a big building exploding and think, cool, dude, wow. Terrorists were always cartoon creatures that were just there to be eventually foiled by the heroes. And whenever the terrorists created their mayhem, it was always a room full of anonymous people who got blown up. I can't imagine anybody watching a movie now filled with pyrotechnics. with the same kind of innocence we had before. You know, every country in Europe went through World War II, where they went through horrible experiences. And America hasn't been under fire. And suddenly we're under fire here.
European cinema is not known for dazzlingly rendered disasters. Gray suggests that American movie mayhem is popular there, partly because the chaos happens here. They can savor it and shrug it off, just as we have. But there was no shrugging off the TV footage seen around the world on 9/11. British novelist Ian McEwan.
Nothing Hollywood ever dreamed up prepared us for a minute for any of this. Because we know the difference. We're not stupid. Even before the towers crumbled and we were simply watching through telephoto lens, we knew we could imagine the hell inside as people ran for their lives, that we knew the elevators would not be working. We knew the pandemonium that must be going on in the stairwells as people try to get down. Also, there are no heroes, not at that stage. There are only victims. That's unlike Hollywood. Those Hollywood dramas seem piffling alongside this.
In the immediate aftermath of 9/11, we wondered what movies people were watching for perspective or solace. When we called a video store on New York's Upper East Side, the manager said that romantic comedies were flying out of the place. No disaster films, he said, except one, The Siege, made in 1998, an action film with terrorists and a message.
What if what they really want? What if they don't even want the shake? Have you considered that? Huh? What if what they really want is for us to herd children in the stadiums like we're doing and put soldiers on the street and have Americans looking over their shoulders, bend the law, shred the Constitution just a little bit? Because if we torture him, General, we do that and everything that we have bled and fought and died for is over. And they've won.
For 8 years, Hollywood has been processing the 9/11 attacks. Stephen Prince, a professor of cinema at Virginia Tech, has reflected on their impact on the big screen in his new book, Firestorm, American Film in the Age of Terrorism. He says that one constant in the films before and after the event is the reaction of celluloid crowds to big bangs.
One of the things that always happens in big disaster movies is that people panic and stampede and scream and yell at one another. And that's what we see in Steven Spielberg's War of the Worlds.
Don't throw us over, but stand up!
There's plenty of room! There's room for hundreds more!
It was consciously meant to be a reply to the 9/11 events. And what all that misses is the remarkable spirit of cooperation that prevailed at the World Trade Center. This was the great challenge that feature filmmakers confronted: how to create stories that would capture the truth of these attacks.
In Spielberg's film, The Terminal, Tom Hanks plays a guy from a mythical country who's country basically goes into upheaval. By the time he lands in the airport, it is no longer recognized by the United States. He's a man without a country. He has to live in the airport. What does that say about us, do you think, post 9/11?
The Terminal is a wonderful and overlooked film. It's a film about America being closed.
Mr. Navorsky, I'm going to need you to look at that. Beyond those doors is American soil. Mr. Dixon wants to make it very clear to you that you are not to enter through those doors. You are not to leave this building. America is closed.
About a country that, as the movie depicts, is full of immigrants who have brought so much, and yet the policy of cracking down on immigration after the attacks denied the best attributes of the country.
Well, what do I do? There's only one thing you can do here, Mr. Navorsky. Shout.
The villain of the picture is a Homeland Security official, and the Homeland Security logo appears prominently at several points in the film.
So talk about now the relevance of his film Munich.
Munich is a movie that is not a crowd pleaser like these others. Munich, of course, being a film about the 1972 massacre of the Israeli athletes at the Munich Olympics.
People are weeping, tearing their clothes. The funerals, which will be held tomorrow in Jerusalem, are expected to draw tens of thousands of mourners. These are the names of the members of the Israeli team at the school.
We have a very sustained, serious attempt to think about the morality of both terrorist violence on the one hand and how a state responds to that on the other. what makes the film so striking is the empathy that Spielberg shows for both sides in that struggle. And this gave the film a measure of controversy when it came out. The ending of the movie is quite haunting. In the last seconds of the film, the camera pans over the Manhattan skyline to reveal the World Trade Center. And that's our closing image.
In the aftermath of 9/11, some of the feature films that dealt with it were actually faithful depictions of the events that occurred. I'm thinking of a film like United 93 that was directed by Paul Greengrass and the World Trade Center directed by Oliver Stone.
Those two movies are remarkably different from one another. World Trade Center is based on the experiences of two Port Authority policemen who were trapped in the rubble of the collapsing towers. It treats the attacks as mostly an off-screen event. The many horrifying things that occurred that day have little to no screen presence. In this respect, United 93 is interestingly different. Greengrass in that film does show the strike on the second tower, and he presents in really harrowing detail the encounter on the titular flight between the hijackers and the passengers.
We're going to take back the airplane.
What? No, no, no. Just sit down, be still, be quiet. Don't draw attention to yourself.
Dina, you're going to take us into the ground. We've got to do something. It's up to us to do it. No one else can.
What do you want me to do?
Pray, Dina.
This was the great challenge that feature filmmakers confronted, how to create stories that would capture the truth of these attacks.
You argue, though, that the most successful formula for a post-9/11 box office success is to fit the terror films into genre movies. The genre gets the audience in their seats, and the terror references just add food for thought. You give examples that basically range from The Dark Knight to Harold and Kumar Escape from Guantanamo Bay.
Yes, and isn't this the opposite of what was initially claimed after 9/11? That Hollywood would need to find new formats in order to portray the events? What happened is that the industry kept all of its conventions and formats and simply found ways of absorbing this material into them. So you can have a movie like Iron Man, where he goes to Afghanistan and gets mixed up with thugs and terrorists, but there are no Taliban and no Islamists anywhere to be found. The Dark Knight is a film where you have the Joker as an anarchist intent on sowing chaos in Gotham City.
Introduce a little anarchy. Upset the established order, and everything becomes chaos. I'm an agent of chaos. Oh, and you know the thing about chaos? It's fear.
But he's not somebody that has a political program for acting the way he does. Bin Laden, by contrast, has reasons that he has specified at length. So all of this packaging is a way of addressing the world that we know we inhabit, but not in ways that threaten the entertainment value of big franchise pictures.
How does Harold and Kumar fit into this?
Harold and Kumar is one of the very few films that has used humor to probe the post-9/11 world.
Do we have the right to make a phone call?
I'm sorry. You want rights now. You want freedoms right now. Is it time? Is it freedom o'clock? Guess what?
What?
Where you guys are going, they have never even heard of rights.
There's a small sequence in the film where they're captured at Guantanamo on suspicion of being terrorists, and a Homeland Security official interrogates them and wipes his rear with the Bill of Rights. That's about as politically pointed as the humor in the film gets.
Don't you wipe?
Don't ask questions you don't want the answer to, buddy.
The movies have been working very hard to persuade us that we're in good hands, that the security forces are a jump ahead of the terrorists, and that they're going to find out about the plots in the nick of time. We know the story of 9/11 was very different. It was a story of chaos and breakdown in the chain of command. This is something our films have not shown us very honestly. Instead, they acknowledge the kind of world that we all know we now live in, And they make it habitable by reassuring us that in the end, everything is going to be okay.
All right. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Stephen Prince is a professor of cinema at Virginia Tech and author of Firestorm, American Film in the Age of Terrorism.
That's it for this week's show. On the Media was produced by Jamie York, Mike Vuolo, Mark Phillips, Nazanin Rafsanjani, Michael Bernstein, and PJ Vogt, with more help from Dan Mazzi and James Harver, and edited by Brooke. We had technical direction from Jennifer Munson and more engineering help from Zach March.
Katya Rogers is our senior producer and John Keefe our executive producer. Bassist composer Ben Allison wrote our theme. You can listen to the program and find transcripts at onthemedia.org. You can also post comments there or email us at onthemedia@wnyc.org. This is On the Media from WNYC. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield.
Support for On the Media comes from the Ford Foundation, the Jane Marcher Foundation, the Overbrook Foundation, and the listeners of WNYC Radio. This is NPR.
On Notes from America, we have conversations with people across the country about how we can truly become the nation that we claim to be. Each week, we talk about race, our politics, education, relationships, usually all of them, because everything's connected. And you, our listeners, are at the center of those conversations. I'm Kai Wright. Join me on Notes from America, wherever you get your podcasts.